Welcome to the program for Friday, February 10th, 2012, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's 3 o'clock time for the Federal News Countdown. Every week, two people who are experts in the world of the federal government choose the news stories from the week that they think are the three most important to people who work for the federal government, rank them in order, and then come in the studio with me and count them down from number three to number one on the Federal News Countdown. This week, it is Stan Soloway from the Professional Services Council. Always good to see you, my friend. Thanks for coming
in. Good to be here, Francis.
And Dan Chenick from the IBM Center for the Business of Government, and I owe you an apology. As a matter of fact, I intended to have a birthday cake or cupcakes or something here. Yesterday was Dan's birthday.
I know this. I was told when I came in here you were going to sing.
Well, that's was told to you by somebody who has never heard me sing.
I'm afraid you're going to sound more like Francis the Talking Mule.
If not having the cupcakes means that I don't have to hear Stan sing, that might be a good thing.
All right, then that's your birthday present. You'll not have to hear either one of us sing to you. Happy birthday.
All right, very good.
I don't want to hear Francis the Singing Mule.
Nobody wants to hear anything to do with me singing, but I appreciate both to be being here, and of course we'll start with, as we always do,
number three.
The third most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Stan Soloway, is from Federal Computer Week. The headline is "College Grads Uninterested in Government Careers." Is this really as bad as it sounds from the headline, Stan? Do you think?
I think it's. But we don't have as great comparative data, but it sounds very low. It's 6% of college grads interested in a government career, but only about 2% are considering the federal government. And when you look at the demography of the federal government, the 200,000 to 300,000 people are expected to exit over the next few years just because of retirements. There is a great need for an influx of new talent to the federal government. Mm-hmm. And if we're not attracting the best and the brightest from college, even a reasonable percentage of interest into the federal government, then I think we've got a big problem. And it suggests to me that there's a declining sort of self-selected pool of people who are looking at the government as a career or even as a stop. And I think that's a challenge for the government, something we need to really be serious about addressing, because whether you're in the private sector or the government side, you need a strong civil service. And I do worry, given the demography, that we're not going to be able to replenish where we need to really replenish.
Now, my colleague Emily Kopp, who follows human resources issues for Federal News Radio and federalnewsradio.com, did a follow-on story to this where a couple chief human capital officers in government said that may be the results of a survey, but we're not having any trouble getting resumes from people who are college age and trying to come in at an entry level into the government. So I guess that could be a silver lining.
It could be, but I think there's two things, and the partnership addressed this a couple of years ago. One is who's applying.
Mm-hmm.
And second, in certain categories of capability, there are pretty good people coming in. We're getting some good young people coming into government. I'm not suggesting that there's no one coming in and that some of those coming in aren't talented. But a couple of years ago, there was a survey about those who had come into government recently, asked them why. What were their primary reasons? And two of the top three reasons were job security and some places they wanted to go for a career.
Mm-hmm.
On one level, coming into public service for a career, that's a good thing. But on the other level, if someone came to you or me or Dan or anyone else and said, I want to come work for you because I'm looking for job security and I want to stay someplace for a career, the first red flag would come up and say, that's not typical of this current generation, mm-hmm. of the innovators and the hard drivers. And so the question is, who's applying?
Yeah.
So it is a mixed bag, but I think it's just another highlight of the government's need to get out there and really find ways to compete for talent that our companies like Dan and others are competing for against a broad commercial marketplace where some of those most critical skills are in very short supply.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you're seeing some adjustment in the government with creative programs, for example, the Tech Fellows program that Steve Van Roekel is championing from OMB, which would take the Presidential Management Fellows program and add a technology component.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that, where people who are attracted to specialty occupations can look at the government and see a career path,
mm-hmm.
will help with that.
I thought was the most disappointing in this was 17.9% of former interns said that they were looking forward to a career in government. I would hope that if you were in government, you had a good enough experience that 82% of them, my math skills backwards are not that hot, 82% of them wouldn't say, well, you know, I've tried it, but that's not really for me.
It's absolutely right. And 80% of the new hires in acquisition at DOD are interns, mm-hmm. somewhere around 80%. The government is still structured around an expectation you're going to stay for a career.
Mm-hmm.
And until we adjust that and recognize that, A, they're not going to stay for a career, and B, we're going to lose sizable percentages, that's a problem. One last point on what Dan just said that I think is the other piece, and then we can leave the topic, which is, throughout this whole budget debate and a lot of the policy discussions, it's very much a we versus they. It's we're either going to private sector good, public sector bad, private sector good. What this says to me is particularly in the higher end skill sets and technology and elsewhere, government has to be incredibly realistic and disciplined about the numbers they think they can bring in and how they then partner with and collaborate with the private sector for a lot of those other skills. Because if you think you're going to just wholesale replace government folks retiring or contractors, these numbers say you're not going to be able to do that, so you better get real.
Stan Soloway, story number three in the countdown is from Federal Computer Week. The headline is College Grads Uninterested in Government Careers. Dan Chenick, your story number three is from NextGov. The headline is Commerce Recommends Industry Lead Internet ID Board. And you cheated, actually. You put two stories in here, which I normally frown on. But since it's your birthday this week, I'll let you slide.
Your
3A is an FCW story headline. GSA open to outsourcing federal PKI operation, the public key infrastructure system. What do you see here?
The reason that I put both these together, and it actually relates to a point Stan just made, is that there are new ways of the government working with the private sector in a particular area. In this case, it's in the identity management space, where the government in the first story, which is really the main one, the second one sort of a ride along, if you will, the government, the Commerce Department, with the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace, which really says to everybody, we have a strategy that's not a government strategy. It's a nationwide strategy to try to enable you to do commerce online in a secure way, just like you do banking online in a secure way. You can do all kinds of other things in a way that's both secure and interoperable. So it doesn't matter if you use your BlackBerry, your iPhone, your computer, some other device, and you can basically authenticate yourself in a consistent manner so that the person you're doing business with knows that it's you, regardless of the device you work on. And this article talks about a governance board that would be led by the private sector, not by the government, to make this whole process go, where the government's acting as a sponsor and basically a cheerleader almost and a participant, but that the leadership for the board comes out of the private sector. And it's an innovative model for a public-private partnership in a policy area.
When I saw this, and not being a technology guy like Dan is, but when I saw this, the first thing that occurred to me is the question of why would we want to try to have the government go reinvent something that's already robustly being worked on in the private sector? And that's not to say the private sector always gets it right. But my technology friends say to me, one of the most important companies in Silicon Valley of the last decade has been PayPal. And what they did was security around payment. In fact, if you look at companies like Yelp and others, they're all PayPal refugees after the acquisition by eBay. And so you look at that and go, this stuff happened without government involvement. We want some governance with the government, we want the government to be involved for obvious reasons. But why would you want to go try, or why would you assume that the government could go do this itself when it's so robustly being done elsewhere?
Well, that has been my point of lack of clarity, I guess, when it comes to NSTIC, Dan, is what's the vision for what I'll be able to do after all of this happens that I can't do today?
You'll have more consistency across government and private sector credentials so that, let's say right now you use a credit card to authenticate and to do some transactions with a commercial provider, let's say eBay or a bookseller or something. If the NSTIC standards work properly, the government can say, as Stan just said, the private sector's gotten it right. We're going to accept the same level of risk for that transaction. And if you're going to do a student financial aid transaction with the government, you can use that private credential that you have. And as long as we accept that credential, that credit card in your wallet that you have now, we'll accept that. You don't need to get a separate government credential.
Okay.
So it's a matter of getting the standards lined up and sure government and industry agree on what those standards look like.
I love having him on the show, Stan, because he can explain that stuff that I don't understand in a way that I can understand it, and I love that.
That's the beauty of Dan.
Dan Chenick's story number three in the Federal News Countdown this week is from NextGov. The headline is Commerce Recommends Industry Lead Internet ID Board. And you can find it, like all of our stories on the countdown, linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The second most important federal news story of the week from Dan Chenick and Stan Soloway when the Federal News Countdown continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Power. powered by the latest second-generation Intel Xeon processors, new HP ProLiant G7 servers are a perfect high-speed solution for lowering costs, improving utilization, and reducing server sprawl. GovConnection, a federal elite HP partner, can show you how together they can power your data center into the future. Talk to GovConnection's experienced federal sales team, where service and commitment to the customer are priority one. Call 800-800-0019 today.
Hi, this is O'Donna Matthews. What does three decades of service add up to? For the Capital Area Food Bank, it includes these important numbers. Distributing 25 million pounds of food to nearly 500,000 people through a network of 700 partner agencies. 30 years, it's a long time. But the mission continues to make sure that no one is left hungry. To learn more, contribute, or volunteer, visit CapitalAreaFoodBank.org.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth every Saturday here on Federal News Radio at 10 a.m. Please join me this week for my special guest, Todd Feldman of Core Financial Advisory, who's going to tell us about certified financial planning and his special buckets of investment. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin Feldman & Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia, serving the entire D.C. metro area. Visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out, when someone gives blood and a life is saved, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
Meeting Mission Goals Through Health, brought to you by General Dynamics IT.
The Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology is working to identify some best practices for mobile devices. The project aims to help medical providers secure and protect health information on laptops, tablets, and smartphones as those devices continue to proliferate throughout the clinical sector. The ONC will gather public input to identify good practices and then plans to spread those practices through what it promises will be clear, concise, easy-to-understand language.
General Dynamics IT is meeting the challenges of a complex healthcare environment that requires far-reaching experience and full-spectrum capabilities. Government, military, and commercial health payer organizations rely on General Dynamics IT's health services, solutions, and support to tackle their toughest issues. General Dynamics IT's broad understanding of healthcare data, military health missions, fraud, waste, and abuse protection, and more ensures support and innovation tailored to your real-world needs. Today's healthcare challenges are formidable. To learn more, go to GDIT.com.
I'm Jared Serbu. Here's what we're working on for tomorrow's edition of The Federal Drive. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office releases a bundle of new regulations to implement the America Invents Act. We talk to USPTO Director David Kappos and what federal managers need to do to take the step up to the SES. We'll hear from an expert. Those stories and more tomorrow morning, starting at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown today includes the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Dan Chenick of the IBM Center for the Business of Government and Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council. And we're up to
number two.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Stan Soloway's from Defense News. The headline is DOD Wants Innovation, Firms Want Less Risk. One of the things I'm not clear on, Stan, is if agencies, including DOD, know what they mean when they say they want innovation, or are they expecting industry to just bring it to them and say, here it is, now you know what it looks like?
I think you're absolutely right. I think they're somewhat schizophrenic about it. And the reason I selected this story is not just because of this story. This is an issue that I think is one of the core issues we face today and will face for the next several years in this austere environment we're in. Secretary Panetta, group of us in industry met with him just a couple weeks ago. He's talked a lot about needing more innovation and so forth. The question we have, the question I have, and the significance to me of this story is they want innovation, but are they buying innovation?
Mm-hmm.
And innovation has many definitions and it has many parents. In some cases, innovation is defined by some folks as, well, just give me the same thing for 5% less money, and that's innovative. In other cases, innovation involves, by definition, risk. And in this story, headlines, firms want less risk. I think more accurately, they want to balance the risk. But the second part of buying innovation is how you go about doing your acquisition. And I don't want to get down in the weeds on contract policy and all that kind of thing. But if, as we now see across government, and DOD is right in the middle of this, a massive increase in the use of low-price buying strategies, even for relatively significant needs, then you are curtailing the ability of companies to drive innovation on a continual basis because you're driving to a low-price environment where you're technically average, you're okay, we're just going to do a price shootout. Well, how do I actually invest in excellence, and what's my reward for doing it?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a balancing act that we're going to have to strike here. An austere environment actually gives you the opportunity to do that if you buy smart. The challenge is that the natural market forces are, I got to book revenue just to book revenue and survive the downturn. So how you buy becomes critical, and I think that this is going to be a continuing tension point for DOD and for many other areas of government.
I would think the incentive part of it, Dan, would be the biggest hang-up there is if I spend a lot of time developing this and I don't have any idea if I'm going to sell it, I might as well just make the thing as cheap as – the solution as cheap as I can to be able to get the deal and just and be happy to do that.
It may lead to a bifurcated type of approach from companies where they really have sort of their low-end – production lines, if you will, from, on the services side or on the product and software and hardware side for a technology company or the weapon side for a platform company. But they may also look at, is there a slice of innovation so that we can basically answer the mail from the secretary? So, because they still want to be able to speak in the room, in the boardrooms, in the rooms of the chief executives and say, we are doing the innovation that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So they may find pockets of opportunity for that while they're, as Stan said, really proceeding to try to hit the low price area.
But that sounds to me like companies are going to have to build two infrastructures to be able to deliver both business models there. Is that...
Well, I don't know if it's
accurate.
Always building two infrastructures. I think what they're doing is they're constantly doing this a constant guessing game. A request for proposals comes out, and it seeks innovation, and we're going to look for this, this, and this. And then you really have to go pretty deep soul searching. Is the customer serious? Are they willing to pay for it? Innovation will cost you a little bit more money in the upfront, but in the back end, it's going to drive costs down. That's the whole point of innovation is it drives more efficiencies and higher performance. In a budget environment such as we have, where everything is tied to the in-year budget and the organization or the components budget, it makes it very difficult unless you have some pretty visionary leaders who are saying, we're willing to invest a little bit more here. And there are some of those folks in government. It's not absolute, but there are some real challenges. I had the opportunity to lead one of the discussions at the DHS Industry Day a few weeks ago and took a poll of the audience because this issue came up from the audience. There was 500-600 people. And we had all the Richard Spires and Luke McCormick, the senior leadership from the components on the stage. And I asked how many of you have seen a radical increase in the use of sort of low price, technically acceptable strategies where you actually were thinking you really want innovation. You want technology refresh. You want continuous improvement. You want workforce investment. And I swear 95% of the hands went up. And the leadership understands this. Every company I talk to, they know that there is this disconnect between we want innovation, we want to drive it. But the way the budgeting system works, the way the comptrollers operate, components are not being incentivized to actually buy that way. And I think that's the conflict. And you're going to see it in IT. You're going to see it in national security requirements and so forth. How do you optimize? How do you actually get the best of the best?
The thing about innovation that I wonder, too, is if we're spending too much time thinking about innovation only limited to the technology field. There's a quote in here from Secretary Panetta. We're depending on a great deal on being at the technological edge of the future. Can we do that? Can we develop the kind of technology we're going to need? That's where the focus of innovation is. Is that fair? Or?
So I'm the IT guy here.
Sure.
And I would say that's right. We need to look well beyond technology for innovation. Process innovation, organizational innovation, streamlining can save just as much and can have a major impact on how government provides services to taxpayers and to beneficiaries, how it deals with companies, and can really bring government closer to those people in a way that, the technology, you could spend a lot of money on technology but not drive as much as much of a result.
That's absolutely right. If a real innovation is not just bringing some piece of technology equipment to the table, it's how it changes the nature of work, how it changes the organization, and so forth. It involves a broad change management approach and change strategy, which is something the government struggles with in the best of times. And in austere times where people are sort of battening down the hatches, it becomes even tougher. But Dan's right. It's not just the technology. It's what it enables you to do more broadly.
But the sense that I get from what vendors are telling me, their interactions with the agencies agencies are telling them is technology or innovation to the agencies is bring me some gadget or some doodad that does something that I can't do now or does it differently than I do it now. And that's the concept of innovation.
There's a mixed bag, and I think Dan touched on this a minute ago. There's also, you got to pick and choose, and that's part of what the significance of Secretary Panetta's quote. You don't need cutting edge in everything. You need to really target and be disciplined to where you're going to get the real return. And the only way you can do that is partner and collaborate very closely with the outside world, figure out where those great returns are, and incentivize people to bring them to the table.
And some agencies are really focusing on this, especially those that are working in shared services like OPM, FAA, who are looking at organizational and process change as well as technology change.
Stan Soloway's second most important federal news story of the week is from Defense News. The headline is DOD wants innovation firms want less risk. It's linked up now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Dan Chenick's second most important federal news story of the week is next up on the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose.
I have this dream where I'm wading through a crowd. Now and then, someone stops and offers me a new job, and it seems like the opportunities are endless. Soon I'm doing the work I've always wanted to do, designing smarter energy systems that transform communities, save millions of dollars, and... Wait, that's no dream. That actually happened. After I got my master's degree in electrical engineering from Capital College.
Capital's master's program in electrical engineering prepares you for some of today's most in-demand jobs. It's conducted online with live streaming audio, so you get the interactivity of a classroom without having to fight traffic to get there. And Capital is one of only 8 colleges and universities nationwide endorsed by IEEE as a provider of a quality engineering education.
I'm living out my dream because of Capital College. It isn't for everyone, but it's perfect for me.
For a virtual info session on graduate programs at Capital College, visit capital-college.edu/radio. That's capital with an O, -college.edu/radio.
On November 17, 2011, the future of air and missile defense changed forever. MEADS, the Medium Extended Air Defense System, demonstrated the first-ever over-the-shoulder launch against a simulated target. It was an unprecedented breakthrough and proved that only MEADS, with its 360-degree coverage, can defend our warfighters against air and missile defense threats from any direction. MEADS has the advanced capabilities and reliability that the 40-year-old Patriot system can't provide and will cost half as much to man and maintain versus upgrading Patriot. MEADS 360-degree coverage defends more area with fewer assets and has the lethality to defeat advanced threats. Defending more, costing less. MEADS. For more information, go to MEADS-AMD.com. That's MEADS-AMD.com.
Paid for by Lockheed Martin.
Your new Cocker Spaniel is waiting to meet you, and you don't have to travel very far. This weekend and almost every weekend, Oldies But Goodies Cocker Spaniel Rescue holds at least one adoption show in the greater D.C. area. Find out where we'll be this weekend by checking out CockerSpanielRescue.com. Stop by to meet the many homeless Cockers of all ages who are looking for their new home. These dogs have already been spayed or neutered and have all their shots. For more information on adoption, fostering, or volunteering, visit CockerSpanielRescue.com.
Eat what? Fruits and veggies. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. Mom and Dad might tell teens to eat their fruits and veggies, so what do teens do? At the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, researcher Sonia Kim saw an answer in national survey data.
We found that 1 in 4 teens were eating fruit less than once a day, and 1 in 3 were eating vegetables less than once a day.
Teens should get the equivalent of 4 or 5 cups of fruits and vegetables a day, more if they're physically active. A cup is about a medium apple or a large tomato. Kim suggests parents keep more fruits and vegetables around the house. Schools provide fruits and vegetables through meals, salad bars, and gardens, and teens reach for a fruit or vegetable more often. The study was in CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Government financial managers are committed to produce timely, reliable, and useful financial information. Stay on top of issues that affect you at AGA's 10th Annual National Leadership Conference, February 16th and 18th at the Ronald Reagan Building and International Trade Center. AGA's NLC features the latest tools and innovations to help agencies do their jobs more easily and more effectively. Don't miss it. Register today at agacgfm.org/NLC.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown every Friday in the 3 o'clock hour. Two people who are experts in the world of the federal government choose the news stories they think are most important to people who work for the federal government. Rank them in order from number 3 to number 1 and come in and count them down with me in the studio on the Federal News Countdown. My experts this week are Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council and Dan Chenick of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. Dan, your second most important federal news story of the week is Jason Miller's story from this week, headlined FedRAMP Eases Vendors' Path to Offer Secure Cloud Services. Is FedRAMP shaping up in your mind to be all it was cracked up to be when it was conceived?
Well, I think FedRAMP has the potential to be terrific. And I did want to say that part of the reason I picked this was because Jason Miller of Federal News Radio is the author. FedRAMP is a strong concept which is being implemented well at the start. Vendors are very interested in it. The other thing I thought was interesting about this is it's yet another example of the government trying to look at how do we work with the private sector in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So the main point of this story is that it doesn't just have to be the agency that gets the approval for a cloud system. A company who's a cloud provider, whether it's Amazon, Google, IBM, or any other company, can go to a board, a government board, and get essentially pre-certified. The government board will say your cloud offering is good, and that way when the agencies go to procure, they've got a higher level of confidence that those companies have done something that is valid, reliable, and can give them the type of performance that they need. So mm-hmm. it kind of streamlines the process, makes it more interoperable across government agencies.
My fear here, Stan, is the way that Jason explained this to me on the air this week is you get your cloud offering approved by the JAB, the Joint Authorization Board, but the agencies then can still review it. And so if we're back to the situation where the agency still will have an examination process and an evaluation and so on, have we really accomplished what the original spirit of FedRAMP was? Even though FedRAMP has done what it's supposed to do, is the whole system improved to the level that we would like to see?
Well, looking at it from where I sit, and I'd let Dan say if I'm right or wrong on this, I think that Dan's right, that Dave McClure and Kathy and the team at GSA have done a tremendous job getting this up and running, and it's conceptually exactly the right way to go. But what you're touching on, I think, is the ongoing sort of schizophrenia or discussion around cloud, and that is what is cloud to different people? How much of it's private cloud? How much of it is agency specific? What are the unique security protocols? There's Vivek's article in the New York Times of a few months ago, Vivek Kundra's article, where he said that he thinks the security debate is over, that Google and Amazon security protocols are as good as, or not better than anything the government's prescribing, and others in government and other companies would disagree. So there's an ongoing sort of discussion around that. So we don't have a final answer. What I think is to GSA's credit is that it didn't wait for that final answer. They got going on FedRAMP, got the process started. That debate, which is really a security debate and unique protocols, is one that's still to be played out. I don't know, Dan, if you would agree with that, but I think that's sort of what I think where you're going with it.
Uh-huh.
No, I think that's right, Stan. And I think what this does, it gives more information to the system. Had it not been for this process, the agencies would have made those judgments anyway, and they might have been all over the map because of the issues that Stan's raising. This provides some sort of a baseline for them to draw on that's a commonly understood set of approval criteria, if you will, not formal approval, but, basically an approval by the JAB that the agencies can consider. The other thing I'd mention just as a footnote on this story is just today in the Washington Post, former Secretary of DHS Michael Chertoff had a long op-ed about privacy in the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And so this talks about the government's really been paying attention to security.
Uh-huh.
But privacy is also, like security, an important issue. And all of us have personal information that we give up all the time in our home lives to Google and through Gmail and to Facebook, et cetera. And those are basically cloud-type systems.
Mm-hmm.
And And the more that the privacy information becomes at risk, the more we have to pay attention to that as a government. And that's really the point of the story, is that this is really getting us into these new types of issues.
Point of shameless self-promotion. On Tuesday, March 6th, Dave McClure and Kathy Conrad will be here in the 3 o'clock hour to do a pretty deep deconstruction of what is going on with FedRAMP and other things that are going on in the Office of Citizen Services and Innovative Technologies at GSA. But FedRAMP is going to be the primary thing that we really dig into for that hour. That's March 6th in the 3 o'clock hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. In that vein, if you were here for that conversation, what would you want to ask them? What would you want to know that we haven't heard yet about FedRAMP? Stan, you go first.
Well, having had the conversation with Dave McClure recently...
You cheated, essentially, is what you're saying.
Well, you know, not being the technology expert that Dan is, I'm like you, I'm still trying to parse through what the language actually means. My question is, how do we now get to that next level of discussion around how you establish some set of security protocols so you can open the aperture and not have this sort of catch-alls or in one agency that don't apply elsewhere? The loose analogy I'd use is to security clearances. We spent years trying to get commonality across the agencies for individual personal security clearances and still struggle with that. We've gotten better. This is that in spades, because it's the potential damage that could be done if we get it wrong is pretty significant for the reasons Dan highlighted. There are national security implications and so forth. But that next level is important because companies are – all of folks in the business are now bringing cloud offerings to the table of varying kinds. And as you're planning and looking down the road and you're trying to figure out what the next generation of technology looks like, we need to get to that next step of some commonality. I agree with Dan. This is a framework. It's a terrific first step. How do we get to that next step? And that may be harder than where we've gotten to now.
Mm-hmm. Dan,
and I would say, well, first, how are we going to deal with privacy? Uh-huh. My last point, because I always want to mention the word privacy anytime I come here. But also, in addition to Stan's point about commonality, there's common language. And people think FedRAMP means something different, private cloud, public cloud, hybrid cloud. How would Dave and Kathy really work with agencies to evolve so that companies will know that a certain type of offering that they're trying to sell to the government, which is consistent with what they're trying to do for citizens all over the country, means the same thing to a government agency that it might to a citizen or a state government or a corporate client that that company's working with?
Dan Chenick's second most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is FedRAMP eases vendors' path to offer secure cloud services. It's linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. All that's left on this week's Federal News Countdown is the most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Stan Soloway and Dan Chenick. We'll continue this week's Federal News Countdown in minutes on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The Financial Safari Radio Show features some of the best retirement planners from across the country and is your source for a common sense approach to planning for a secure retirement in Northern Virginia. Contact the father-daughter retirement planning team of Don and Jill O'Rourke at 1-800-664-7505.
Tune in to the Financial Safari with the father-daughter team of Don and Jill O'Rourke, Sunday mornings at 8 a.m. right here on 1500 WFED.
My family struggled, and it was assumed that while I would go to college, I would have to pay for it myself.
Charlie wasn't sure how to get the money she needed for college. Then she found out about federal student aid and the FAFSA.
I don't think I quite realized what a huge deal actually graduating was. Federal student aid definitely made that happen.
Need help planning and paying for college? Find out more at college.gov.
My name is Charlie, and this is my story.
Federal pay and benefits are once again being debated in Congress. The House has passed a one-year extension to the current federal pay freeze, and Senate Republicans have introduced a bill to freeze federal pay and hiring in order to stop massive automatic defense cuts in 2013. FederalNewsRadio.com's pay and benefits page has the latest on congressional action affecting your pocketbook. Find it at FederalNewsRadio.com. Search term pay and benefits.
Newsmakers talk to Emily Kopp.
Rob Shriver, OPM's Deputy General Counsel for Policy.
We really are emphasizing transparency and internship opportunities. So our proposed pathways regulations require agencies to put up on our USA Jobs website some basic information about the internship opportunities that are available to them. It's a requirement that's not currently in place.
Hear the entire interview online at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive.
This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by two people who are experts in the world of the federal government. This week it's Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council and Dan Chenick of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. And we're up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week, according to Dan Chenick, is from NextGov. The headline is, outgoing federal CTO talks transparency and bottom-up change. And a lot of the concepts included in this NextGov story are some of the same things that Anish Chopra talked about on the Federal Drive this week on his last day on Tuesday. What do you think his legacy is? Just being the first CTO, or what are the landmarks in his tenure, Dan?
So I think it's more than a niche. It's the position that the president put into place in 2008, back when we were all on the transition team trying to figure out how to set up the White House for success. And Anish, fortunately for the country, chose to accept the appointment of the first chief technology officer for the nation. This story really reflects on some of the successes that that job has had, and also some of the challenges that a job, which is a White House staff job, really has. So Anish really is the president's advisor internally, and he can bring people together. He can advise the president, and has been an effective internal advocate over the course of the last 3 years. But that position, because it was structured basically as a White House staff position, was not the leader of a big initiative. He was more behind the scenes, working with people in the administration, talking to the business community, trying to leverage government levers and business incentives to try to create innovation in different ways. It's a question really of how do you structure the technology leadership position in an administration?
Do you see it the same way, Stan?
I see it very similarly. I remember the discussions during the transition with a lot of the folks around what is the correct role for a CTO, what's the correct role for the CIO, how do they interrelate? And clearly Anish and Vivek Kundra were able to work. They knew each other. They were able to work it together, but the positions evolved. You heard a lot of people over the last couple of years say, well, Anish isn't very visible. And as Dan said, that role really is not the visible champion. That was really Vivek to do the execution. It was, as Dan said, planning, vision, strategy, and so forth. But when I looked at the story, and the headline itself says a lot to me, and one is transparency, the other is bottom-up change. And they're inextricably linked, but they're also two slightly different pieces. The bottom-up change, clearly something that is desperately needed. We've been talking about it within regard to innovation and so forth. Transparency, clearly desperately needed. The public has the right and the desire to know a lot more. However, the caveat to that is I think we're getting to a point with transparency and the transparency initiative. We're getting well past the point of return on the investment where we're getting collecting information for information's sake. We're not using it as a management tool. Mm-hmm. If you look at the new bill pending in the House, it's already passed out of committee, the Data Act. It's now going to require circular reporting of all government payments. So a company gets paid by the government. Every invoice that gets paid, they then have to report through another system back to the government that they got paid this. So we're going to have two completely separate points of data on government payments. In questions, why it's all in the name of transparency, but why? I mean, the government pays me. The government should have a record that they paid me, and there's your transparency. Mm-hmm. We're getting to the point now where there's going to be the data call after data call after data call, whether it's on an agency or on a company. These all have cost. And the question is, how are you using the information? I think to Vivek's credit and what he did in IT and with the dashboards and so forth, they were using the information as a management tool. That makes eminent sense to me. But when you're just collecting data to have the numbers and the data there, that's a cost with very little return on the investment.
So I think that Anish deserves great credit for leading this transparency in terms of it creating this openness, this open government, this open data, open access, et cetera. And he points out in the article about we need to go further around participation and collaboration. I think that it's a stage that you have to go through to get to the point that Stan's describing, which is really using things like analytics and the power of technology and the power of taking information and being able to put it together in different ways through information strategy, essentially, to make sense of all of the all that's out there. And that may be the next phase in the next 4 years as to what we do with in terms of the information that the government holds and how the public uses it.
But in the name of transparency, I'm sorry, just to add one thing. When you look at the legislation I referenced, if you ask folks on the Hill who are behind it, why are you doing this? Their answer is because we don't trust the agencies to get it right. So they're creating a process that doesn't really give you any value add for the So transparency has become a buzzword. I agree with everything Dan just said. But it's becoming a little bit more ubiquitous than just as a management tool that gives you analytics that are usable.
Well, speaking of buzzwords, my prediction at in December of last year was that analytics would be one of the big buzzwords in the government space in 2012 for the reasons that you're talking about, that Dan's talking about. Stan, you see the same thing?
Absolutely. And analytics, it's a big term. I mean, you see a ton of people doing work for the government, analytics in the intelligence community, analytics with regard to spend and management and so forth. If you look at the competition for talent coming out of the better technology schools, Stanford's, the MIT's, the Caltech's, these kids are getting offers from hedge funds and Wall Street to do analytics. I mean, this is a field of great importance, and it's going to expand with regard to government management.
It's not just government. It's all over. Big data is everywhere.
The reason that I made that prediction was because of the amount of information that the government collects and the lack of confidence that a lot of people both in and outside the agencies have in the ability of the agencies inherently to first know what to do with it and then how to look at it to do whatever it is they decide they want to do with it. Is that a fair analysis?
That's a fair analysis. Part of the principle of the transparency agenda was that if you exposed more, you'd have people essentially kind of doing a Wikipedia, if you will, on the government. Repackaging it, making it available, correcting each other on the accuracy of that information, and so you get a self-perpetuating market. And that's why information strategies and analytics can really help to be tools to allow that to happen.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Dan Chenick of the IBM Center for the Business of Government, is from NextGov. The headline is Outgoing Federal CTO Talks Transparency and Bottom-Up Change. It's an outgoing interview with Anish Chopra, the first federal chief technology officer. It's linked up now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The most important federal news story of the week, as chosen by Stan Soloway, is next to wrap up today's Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
Meeting mission goals through IT modernization, brought to you by General Dynamics IT.
The Navy has awarded a contract worth up to $638 million to modernize the IT infrastructure aboard its ships. The Consolidated Afloat Networks and Enterprise Services, or CANES project, will consolidate at least five different network architectures aboard ships. The goal is to install the system on 180 submarines, ships, and maritime operations centers by the year 2020. The first CANES installation is scheduled to go live on a Navy destroyer later this year.
General Dynamics IT delivers the full strength of enterprise IT to drive innovation like infrastructure consolidation and modernization, cross-domain information sharing, cloud computing, Web 2.0, and a constant flow of new applications and IT services. General Dynamics IT helps government, military, and commercial organizations achieve new levels of productivity and mission effectiveness. General Dynamics IT brings together the expertise, technology, and best practices to deliver secure enterprise IT solutions. Go to GDIT.com to learn more. That's GDIT.com.
The Pentagon and Beyond is brought to you by EADS North America.
Military bases are soon going to be serving more fruits, vegetables, and low-fat dishes. This is a part of the first program in about 20 years to improve nutrition standards across the armed services. First Lady Michelle Obama announced the effort during a visit to Little Rock Air Force Base in Arkansas, where the military has been experimenting with the idea through a pilot program designed to improve the quality and variety of foods served on base. I'm J.J. Green.
Airmen, we're on our way.
At EADS North America, we help our country respond to emergencies and natural disasters.
We see you. We're coming in.
From coordinating communications to medevac and emergency response, we provide the mission-critical systems our country demands. Every day, we support homeland security and defense missions here at home and around the globe.
Patient secure. ETA 10 minutes.
EADS North America. Commitment defines us.
Arming your home security system gives you peace of mind, but are you paying $30, $40, $50 or more in monitoring fees? Switch to Ackerman Security Systems, the metro area's most trusted name in security, and pay just $18.95 a month. That's right, $18.95 a month, and no cost to switch. Don't have a system? Then Ackerman offers the latest technology, including wireless monitoring. Call by Wednesday and get 3 months of basic monitoring free when you switch or start service with Ackerman. Call 888-999-1070, AckermanSecurity.com.
Soon this little baby I'm singing to sleep will start to walk. Before I know it, I'll be dropping her off at school, beaming when she walks up to accept her diploma, or holding back tears as she takes those big steps down the aisle. But before she takes all those steps, she and thousands like her will need you to take yours. Join March for Babies to help make her steps possible. Start your team today at marchforbabies.org.
This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Every week on the Federal News Countdown, two people who are experts in the world of the federal government choose the news stories they think are most important to people who work for the federal government. This week, the people selecting the stories are Dan Chenick of the IBM Center for the Business of Government and Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council. And Stan, your most important federal news story of the week is probably going to be number one next week on the countdown, too. It's from the Wall Street Journal, and the headline is Budget Plan Has Familiar Ring. What are you expecting to see on Monday, or what maybe, since you're an insider, have you already been tipped that we might see on Monday?
Well, I think we've all been tipped to what we're going to see in the defense side. I mean, mm-hmm. we know that. That's been pretty public in terms of the top line dollars and some of the cuts. We haven't seen all of it, but they have rolled that out over time. First of all, the top line was decided last summer with the Budget Control Act. So mm-hmm. we know that there's a cap on discretionary spending across the government. We know there's a national security cap for several agencies plus a civilian cap. So those are all obvious. I think what we're going to see on average, this is an average across the agencies, is around that 3-4% level cut that's mostly consistent with the Budget Control Act. I think that we'll probably see some of the, you might call them citizen-facing agencies, the VAs and FAA and folks like that do relatively well, where others, potentially some of the regulatory and other agencies, do less well. I don't expect any great shocks. I mean, I think that this being an election year, obviously, the president's pretty well signaled what he's going to do, what his priorities are going to be. And as you said, this is going to be number one next week. It was number one last week. It's going to be number one for a long time, because the reality is we probably won't see an appropriation this year. This document that goes up Monday, no matter how good and how well constructed, is just the first step of a really brutal debate. Some people are saying it's DOA as a document. That may be true because it'll be modified given the nature of Congress and so forth. But I think the reason that we start on Monday thinking about it, but it's not just the budget. We're looking at another deficit, debt ceiling debate coming up over the next several months, which could be pretty brutal. You've got you've got CBO now in the driver's seat. They are, by under law, the arbiter of the scoring process, where OMB can score whatever they want, but under the Budget Control Act, it's what CBO says. So when the president talks about things like the tax cuts expiring, in CBO's parlance, that's not really relevant to deficit reduction, because they've already assumed in their predictions, the expiration of the Bush tax cuts. So mm-hmm. I think there's an awful lot of pieces to this puzzle, but the bottom line is, for the government and for agencies, is what we've been talking about. For you and I have talked about it. We all talk about this all the time. How are you supposed to plan now? You're looking at a debt ceiling fight. You're looking at a likelihood of not having a bill by the end of September, probably having a CR for how long. We have no idea at this point. We don't know what the dynamics will be at that time. And then you have the threat of sequestration. And remember, sequestration doesn't go into effect until January 1st, which means you have the first quarter of the next fiscal year under current levels, and then all of a sudden, after the first quarter, sequestration kicks in. And how do you roll into that? When do we find out if it's real or not real? It's clearly something you have to factor in. And I think from an agency planning perspective, it's just going to be chaotic again.
The calendar for sequestration I find fascinating, because regardless of what happens in the elections in November, whether the president's reelected or not, sequestration kicks in the first week of January. Is it January 1?
January 1st or January 2nd. Yeah.
Okay. The new president, if there is one, isn't inaugurated until January 20th. So this resides squarely at the White House as we see it today on whether sequestration happens or it doesn't happen. And the president said a number of times, I don't care what Congress sends me to try to change it. I'm not signing anything that will allow changes to the sequestration pattern.
Well, that's what he says today, but we don't know what the dynamics tomorrow will be. And remember also, with January 1, you're stuck with the current Congress because the new Congress won't be sworn in until the first week of January.
Correct.
There were some people argued at the time, if you're going to do this, make it February 1st. You let the new Congress and who's ever in the White House make the decisions. I think we're going to see all kinds of it's completely unpredictable how this plays out, but it is not unreasonable to think that we could go right up to the end deadline, mid-end of December, before agencies are given their final apportionment instructions for January 1st. There are questions about how you do a continuing resolution if it rolls over, if there's no lame duck and you have to roll it into January. How do you do that with the sequestration date? So my point here is, even as we now finally, you know, after one quarter got an FY12 budget and people are moving forward, you're going to see the same sort of bollocksing in the system, the same sort of delays and uncertainty in the system we saw last year, because folks don't know how this is going to play out going into next year.
He's accomplished something that's never been done, Dan. He used the word bollocks on the Federal News Countdown, which is...
Do you need a dictionary,
which is,
Francis?
No, I've been to England.
Bollocks, the B-N-O-M-B.
That's exactly right.
Having been at OMB for 14 budget cycles, including three presidential election years, this is not a new phenomenon where you have an election year budget. And basically, in an election year, a budget like this is a statement of policy priorities. And so with the sequestration and the cuts are, instead of basically having the base budget at a level that's kind of steady, you've now got a level that's sort of the 3% down. But the president's still making policy choices about which areas he wants to invest in, where are the principles that he's going to be running for reelection on. And then OMB as an institution, to Stan's point, has on numerous occasions turned the budget around when the president's changed, or even when there's been a continuation, basically updated the budget between November and the time the budget comes out in February. So it's not something that's new, but the sequestration element adds a wrinkle that we haven't seen before, and it's a big one.
Yeah, it's the deficit reduction piece that makes us different than we've seen before. It's because of the mandatory caps that are there as a result of the act last summer. So the president's flexibility and Congress's flexibility is limited if they wanted to go higher. And then, as Dan said, there's going to be all kinds of fluctuations in this as we go forward. What happens? There's 6 or 8 or 10 different scenarios with regard to what happens with Congress and the White House and what implication that has for short and longer term decision making.
Stan Soloway's most important federal news story of the week is from the Wall Street Journal. The headline is Budget Plan Has Familiar Ring. And of course, we'll have a lot of budget details for you on the air and online on Monday. 11:15 is the time that the budget will be officially available.